I don't remember, but I think the last thing I was talking about was how what mother did with the feeding those people.
We talked about
and
that.
So this was something I saw.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Do you have any observations on the political climate in the city at the time?
In New York?
Yes.
Very little. Mm-hmm. I mean, I knew people laughed at Jimmy Walker.
I see.
And I knew that people admired Alfred Smith, that he had a humane attitude and so forth and so on. And I had a father-in-law who was a very famous man, and he told me that it was with the help of Al Smith that he was able to pass some of the legislation after the Triangle Fire, which protected labor.
It
was very important. But Smith was an extremely bright and able politician who had a heart. And we all knew that, even as kids. I mean, we weren't politically interested, but we knew that about Smith. Mm-hmm. And we knew that Walker was a playboy and that people made jokes about him. But I don't know much about... I do think the first time I really understood what Roosevelt had done was when I was at college. And I began to hear people, including parents of some of my friends who were still Republican, they would say that... Roosevelt was a traitor to his class. And as I saw what his humane measures were doing to help what I had seen as a little girl when I was in college, I realized that Mr. Roosevelt was probably the reason that we didn't have a revolution. I remember one night going to theater with my grandmother. Mm-hmm. That was my father's mother. During the height of the Depression, mm-hmm. and we had a car and chauffeur. And we were stoned a few blocks from the theater.
That was a frightening experience.
It was an experience I never forgot, nor did Grandma. She understood it, because she used to travel abroad every year. But it was something I never forgot. And I think Mr. Roosevelt deserves full credit for probably understanding and being humane enough with his wife to have put in some of the legislation that may have prevented a revolution. And we were able to return to a democracy after World War II.
I've always felt that way.
Many people feel that he has saved the democracy.
I think he did, you know, and of course, it would be somebody like that, wouldn't it? Somebody who had always had stuff, mm-hmm. because I think very often when they are self-made, they say, if I could make it, why can't you? They seem to have lost some of their compassion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You talked about your early school experiences at the Ethical Culture School. Was that at a high school level?
From the time I went to school.
Oh, I see.
I went right through
elementary and high school?
Elementary and high school. My sister didn't like it, and she insisted she wouldn't work, and she till she got mother to change her to the Brearley School by the time she was about in the fourth or fifth grade. But I went all the way through. Again, I was the older. I had been to many of the meetings, and of course, I think it was the leadership of the leaders that made such a deep impression on me. I think, I don't know if anybody cares to hear this, but whether you might even want to not put it on the tape, I don't care. But I feel very strongly that if we had some way, not religious training per se, but ethical leaders available to the schools, that you would have a cut in some of the things that are happening in the schools today, because these were remarkable people. I can't begin to tell you how many things they did stuck with me all my life. They had a weekly ethics meeting. I mean, not in court, it was a class. And it was always headed, even in the third and fourth grades, by a leader who knew how to handle children. And he would, in a very relaxed way, enter a problem. He'd say, supposing you lived along a stream, and so did a number of neighbors. And then up on the top, near the top, lived a man who wanted to put in a sawmill there. How would you feel about that? And then we'd have to begin to think about it, what it meant. You know, what is your obligation to others than yourself, even if he owns his own property? I don't have to explain to you. You understand.
Yeah.
But it was tremendous for us because we learned very young what was meant by having a sense of community and caring for your neighbors and hoping they'll care for you, and how bad it is if people don't think about the environment, you know, things of that sort. And it never left me. And I can tell you that when William Ray was the head of the school, the Board of Education in Pittsburgh, he was a friend of mine, and I took the trouble to talk to him about, couldn't we get some ethical leaders to go into the schools, which would be non-sectarian in every way, because I never heard religion mentioned as such in these discussions at school. He said, I think it would be a marvelous idea, but where would you get the leaders from?
And
it ended. I mean, I couldn't supply the leaders. He obviously wasn't interested enough to suggest that we try and train them or get them from the ethical society. And so it ended. But I still believe that what they did affected everyone who went there, perhaps some much more than I and others less.
Well, it seems to have made a lasting impression.
Quite, absolutely. Absolutely, and I never had a poor leader. Sometimes they would aggravate you beyond words. One of them was a man named Algernon Block, and he became the head of the society.
I knew him.
You knew him. Mm-hmm. And he said, you're all too much from one group. You all live in this area. And he went to the blackboard and he showed us where most of us live. Now he says, you don't understand about what it's like to live in a slum and so forth and so on. And of course this was done, you know, that's the abrasive technique, to see what we'd come up with. And then he'd leave it to us. Well, I got so annoyed with him that I had all I could do, because you don't argue with your teacher, see, he's an adult. So I never was able to tell him that some of us didn't feel that way, that we did care what happened in the slums. But I can remember the technique, because now I understand it. Then I didn't. He just got me awfully mad.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned them as leaders. Were they separate from teachers? Or
yes, you see, these were ethical culture mm-hmm. leaders of the society mm-hmm. who were brought in to handle these classes. They were teachers.
This was independent of the academic program.
Oh, yes. This was not independent. It was part of it. You couldn't go to the Ethical Culture Society and a child would just automatically be in an ethics class.
Well, I understand that, but they did not teach the academics.
Oh, no. But they were all brilliant scholars.
I understand.
In their own fields. But all they did was teach the ethics classes.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall any particular teacher who was a special influence?
Well, I would say Black was, even though he kept making one mad. But I think everyone I had was great. I think Dr. John Lovejoy Elliott, who was as handsome as he was brilliant and as compassionate as he was articulate, would be my favorite of all those I had as leaders. And he became a dear friend. He, as you know, founded the Hudson Guild, and that was one of the great social agencies in New York. But he was something. And Dr. Muzzy was nice, but he was very quiet. And there were several others. There was a Dr. Newman. He was very good, but I never knew him that well. And there was a Dr. Gutman, who was excellent. Those were all leaders. And at one time or another, I had some classes with them.
Who are some of these gentlemen, professors and teachers of the universities?
Oh, yes. Dr. Gutman taught at Columbia. Dr. Sure. Muzzy taught at Columbia.
Sure.
Dr. Elliott was the head of Hudson Guild. I can't begin. They all had something else they were doing.
Because it was a sort of specialized kind of school and a wide age range, were there any discipline problems that ever surfaced?
I suppose so, but very few. You see, I don't think you know how that school was selected. At that time, it isn't anymore. They can't afford it. But the school, Ethical Culture Society School, took one-third of the children as complete scholarships, one-third as partial scholarships, and one-third who paid the whole amount. And this was marvelous. And we were also the first, except for the Quaker school and the Dutch Reform school, the collegiate school, that took blacks. We would have one or two in each class, not enough, I can tell you, because it made it hard for them. But nevertheless, they took blacks. And they had a lot of kids on scholarship, most of whom became very famous, really. They're marvelous, brilliant young people. And no matter how good you thought you were, and I wasn't that good except in a couple of subjects, there'd be somebody else there who'd get 2 points or 5 points higher. It was hopeless. It was hopeless. But that was a marvelous thing to do, because nobody wore a uniform. We all wore smocks for the lab work. And really, though we knew who was well off and who wasn't, it was not a noticeable thing, and not much was made of it.
Did you develop any early interests there that foreshadowed your later career in any way?
Well, because I did have a voice, they always gave me solo parts in the Christmas plays and things like that, you know. But then I had loved music anyway. And I think I had such very good schooling that one of the advantages when I went to Sarah Lawrence College was that I was one of the students that didn't have to be taught how to get her own material. Now, you may not believe that, but at that time, many colleges were using only textbooks. Sarah Lawrence didn't. You had to dig even for your own materials and whatever course you took. Well, we had been doing that the last 2 or 3 years of high school.
I see.
And it was a tremendous help in to be going to a college where you were completely on your own, to know how to get material and how to do this. It took some of the kids there the whole first year to learn how to do independent work. They expected a reading list with all the textbooks, you know.
You find that your background, yes, society, in a sense, made you different from some of the children or youngsters who came to Sarah Lawrence?
I don't think I can give that totally a credit to the school. It may have had something to do. Certainly made you a little more independent-minded, but I have a feeling I was that before. But I do think that that, with the kind of family I had, and the discussions that were held at home, and the people I met, I think had a good deal to do with my getting the very utmost out of college, because I was very fortunate. I had superb teachers there. Superb.
Mrs. Elvis, to come back to New York City, we were asked to your observations on the health care services in the community at the time that you were there.
I wouldn't be able to tell you very much about that. Mm-hmm. I know that there were clinics with most of the hospitals. I know that Henry Street had an outstanding nursing service, but I couldn't really tell you very much.
You really had very little personal
experience. Oh, yes, very little.
Your adolescent years, was it an easy transitional period?
Difficult, very difficult. I'd lost my father when I was 12, the very beginning of adolescence, and had to grow up almost overnight and help take care of the house when mother was on tour, in the sense that I had to be responsible. And though we had governesses and nurses at the time, different ones, I really helped raise my sister.
How much of an age difference is it?
Six.
I see.
6 years.
That was enough to make it.
Oh, yes. She was like my baby.
I see.
You mean you helped rear your sister while your mother was working?
Well, in a way, I certainly had to look after her, and if there was trouble, or I would sometimes have to call the doctor rather than wait for the governess to do it, you know, or grandma or grandpa weren't around to call, or an aunt and an uncle. I had to grow up very fast. It didn't do me any harm, but it came very quickly, you know.
It was a maturing.
Well, yes, and it's a psychic shock, let's face it, to lose a parent. And it was worse for my sister later than it was for me, because I'd known my father for 12 years and she only knew him for 6. We were still a baby then.
Was your mother actually the sole support of the family after your father
died? Oh, no. My father had left means and my grandparents helped. No, it was not that. It was that she wanted to sing. She had no intention of giving it up, and she did make a very good income, because she had been a very great artist, and she got the silver record medal and the gold record, you know, for the quality of her work, and she was very popular.
Now,
she was very beautiful, you know, and she wore glorious clothes, and she had a sense of social conscience that was so nice that she never, when the clothes were 2 years, worn 2 years, and they'd never be worn the same place, and they were great clothes. They were people, every one of the good dressmakers, Bendel in New York, Longvanure, made her clothes. She would then see that they were clean and given to some young artist who was starting on a career and needed clothes. She always did that.
Well, your family had an active social conscience all along the way, I can see that.
Well, these things I can remember. And how beautiful she looked when she went on the stage. Beautiful. Just, I'll show you a picture, stop the machine.
We were talking about outstanding teachers.
Well, I just mentioned two.
But
I had many others. There was Mrs. Van Sinderen, who I think was one of the finest teacher of dramatic literature that I've ever heard of. She literally got us all absolutely fascinated with the great men who were not even as well known then as they are now, like Eugene O'Neill. And again, she worked the dickens out of us. And then I had that marvelous man, René Dononcourt, who was at one time head of the Museum of Modern Art. At that time, he wasn't. And he was teaching us appreciation of art. And let me tell you, when he told me I was to write a paper on Rivera, I said, but Dr. Dononcourt, I don't even know. I know he's Mexican. That's about all I know, Mexican Indian. How am I going to find out what to do? And he said, look at his pictures. And he never gave me another bit of help. And of course, what better teaching? Because when I see them at the different periods, and New York being close by was a lab, I began to ask the right questions, and I found, but he wouldn't help me. I'd have to go before the paper was ready, you know, the Don system, very much like Oxford, Cambridge. I'd have to go and talk to him, and he'd say, good, good, or, well, you might try this museum, you know, giving me just a little hint, no real help. But then...
Did you learn?
Oh, did you learn? You learned.
That's a form of education.
I had the same experience with Otto Kleinberg. He never gave you anything except if whatever your fear was, well, now you'll have to make a report when you think you have it ready.
What did you major in at Cicero?
I majored in two fields, sociology and music.
I see.
And I was recommended. We had a different form of marking. They kept marks for other colleges and schools so they'd know. We never saw them. But they could recommend you if you were doing very well for graduate work. And I was mentioned for graduate work in anthropology and in music, you know, and so that's on my record. I was also one of the first of two class, I was the second class that went to Sarah Lawrence for 4 years. You see, it was a 2-year college.
Oh, I see.
And then many of those who wanted to, and they did, went on to other colleges from there. But Sarah Lawrence, while I was there, turned into a 4-year college. And, well, we were something like those people, they say, the Cabots are, you know, and only speak to the Lord. We thought we were the chosen ones, you see. There were 8 of us, and we felt we were pretty darn good, I'm telling you. But we worked very hard those last 2 years. And we graduated, and then we had this recommendation that I got married.
Oh, I see. You didn't go on to graduate work.
No, I was sorry. But my husband had waited a long time. I had known him a year and a half before we were married. And I suggested that I maybe wait another half year or a year. And he said, nothing doing. You either marry me this June or the thing is off. So
that did it.
That did it. Then I moved to Pittsburgh.
Were there any here? Special friends that you made those years that have carried over?
A few, yes. And some of them are still my friends. Others are far away and I don't see them very often. But I did make some very lovely friends, very creative women, very able women. And most of them married, most of them had children, but many continued with their work. More perhaps than would have in some of the other colleges.
So you had met Mr. Elphison prior to
yes.
finishing school?
Yes, I met him at a dance.
In New York?
In New York.
I see.
Oh, I lived there until I was married.
I see. And when were you married?
In 1935.
And then you moved to Pittsburgh immediately after that?
Yes, I did.
I see. And Mr. Elvis, was he from New York originally?
Oh, yes. From New York and New Jersey. Right.
Can you tell us something about his background?
Well, certainly. He had a very famous father, Judge Abram I. Elkis, who was former ambassador to Turkey. And he was one of the outstanding trial lawyers in the United States. And he became ill during his post as ambassador to Turkey and had to be brought home after he'd had typhus. And I must tell you how that happened, because this is fantastic. He was sent over there by President Wilson as ambassador to Turkey to try to keep Turkey neutral in the war,
World War I.
And he almost succeeded. And the German ambassador spies reported on this. And the German ambassador had a nice little way of doing away with difficult people. He would get a typhus-infected flea and put it in a jellied capsule, then have somebody put it in the headband, inside headband of hats. You know, the men wore hats more than they do now. And then as the heat of perspiration would melt the jellied capsule, the little flea would bite him. And it bit my father-in-law and came down with typhus and probably would have died if he hadn't been a strong man.
How did they discover that?
They knew he did it. And after he got so sick, they checked his hat band and you could see the grease stain of where the jellied capsule had melted. And he became too ill to continue and they brought him home. And he was doing very well and was recovering very well. When Wilson asked him if he was well enough, would he please go and settle the dispute between, on the Åland Islands, the dispute between Sweden and Finland. And he said he would. And his doctor told him not to. He said, yes, you've recovered, you're doing well, but that's going to be a strain and you shouldn't go. You should turn it down. And he said, no. If the president feels this is very important, I can't say no, I'll go. Well, he did resolve the dispute in favor of Finland, and he received the White Rose for Finland from Marshal Mannerheim, that's the Finnish hero, and was decorated. But he got a stroke from it. It happened because he had strained himself too much. And he was then crippled for the rest of his life. He was in a wheelchair. And this was a great tragedy, just a terrible tragedy. But he had a marvelous nature and he accepted it and he saw people, but he no longer could speak clearly. And it was pretty bad. And Jim's mother was a magnificent woman who always took care of husband and made him feel, even though he was crippled, he was the head of the house. She was a great woman, just simply terrific. And her father was a very well-known publisher in New York. His name was Selmar Hess. And they had a very lovely home there in Rumson. And when she was married, the judge bought the house, a big house for them in Red Bank, which was near Rumson, and where they had their summer home, more than their summer home, their home for many years. So they always had a place in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And he was quite a character, typical Prussian, old man Hess, I understand. And he was a neighbor of Jacob Schiff.
Oh, yes.
And who had an adjoining estate. And they would vie with each other. I'm only quoting my mother-in-law. Who could have the first early peas? You know, that was a great triumph. They'd always bring it to the other one, whoever it was, you know. That's what I can tell you. And of course, Jim went away to school. He went to St. Paul's School, and then he went to Yale. And he was in Sheffield, and that was the sort of ahead of the engineering school, which it became.
Jim is who?
My husband.
Your husband. Okay.
And his mother's name was Hess, and he was named James Hess Elkins. And he had, as the head of his school was Dr. Doherty, who then came to Pittsburgh, if you remember, to Carnegie, now Carnegie Mellon, then Carnegie Institute, that's right, Carnegie Tech. And he was the head of the School of Engineering when my husband was there at Yale, graduated in 1933. And Dr. Doherty, of course, my husband knew, and he told us that the finest students he ever had were those that came to him in Carnegie Tech under the GI Bill of Rights. He says they were older, they appreciated the opportunity, and they worked.
They were motivated.
That's what he told us. I was over there.
And what did bring Mr. Elvis to Pittsburgh?
A job with a company for which his father had been the counsel, Law Knox Company, it was then. And so he came to Pittsburgh, and jobs were hard to get in those days. You know, 1933 was still the Depression. We hadn't gotten into the war yet. And that's what he was. He was working there in various different sections of the Law Knox Company. When we met, he was already in that company.
Was it something of a culture shock for you to move to Pittsburgh?
Tremendous. I had traveled all over Europe and over a good part of our own country, and I'd never been in a city as dirty as Pittsburgh. I couldn't believe it was. I said, people don't live here, they exist. Because I was sick all the time. My sinus, I have a weak sinus, and I would suddenly get a terrible attack. You know, get 104 fever and have to call the doctor at 3 in the morning. And it was all, see, we had no air conditioning.
Everybody had
sinus attacks. I was so sick from it. And then I think one of the greatest things was smoke control. Absolutely.
Wasn't it wonderful when it started?
But when that happened was quite a while. It was after the war, if you remember.
Yes.
Did you find it very limited culturally?
Yes and no. I mean, it wasn't what it became after World War II, but I met a lot of people who were interested in the symphony, who were interested in the colleges. Mm-hmm. I always met people like that. But I think Pittsburgh really began to be the place it is now, right after World War II, when that smoke control came in.
Yes, I agree.
Because you see, Mellon couldn't get, he admitted it, the men to work for him. They couldn't.
We're going to be finishing in just a